Yeah, it's great to be back. And that's just up there to rouse your curiosity, but it's actually all over the internet, so we'll talk about it. But for those of you that are new, what we're doing here in the class is going through the major creation texts in the Bible. And we're about halfway through the Bible. We're actually in the book of Ecclesiastes right now, particularly chapter 3 and chapter 4. So we'll be diving into that shortly. But this has been an amazing week of scientific discovery. Some really amazing, some not so amazing. I mean, here's one, for example. Let me pull this one up. The title of the paper was Adolescents in Peer Groups Make More Prudent Decisions When an Adult is Present. It's like, okay, how much of our taxpayer money went to fund this piece of research? And so it caught my curiosity. Okay, what's really going on here? This seems so obvious. But when you actually read the paper, and it was published in Psychological Science, and I don't read too many psychology journals, but this is what I do look at because they really do emphasize a scientific approach to psychology. And what they did was a number of experiments. I mean, yeah, duh. If you have an older adult around, teenagers are more likely to make prudent decisions. But what was good about the experiment is they actually divided it up into different age separations. And we're wanting to measure how many years between the teenagers and the adult do you get the most prudent decisions. And what they discovered is if you throw in an old guy like me into the group, it doesn't have that much of an impact. You know, they just kind of write that off. And those of you who are parents and grandparents have probably experienced that, the teenagers. And so what they discovered was that if the age separation is relatively minor, they get the greatest impact in terms of the teenagers. And so basically you've got a peer group of, say, 15 to 30 teenagers all together. All you need to do is throw in one adult that's, say, 3 or 4 years older, and they behave much more prudently than they otherwise would. But if it's too old or not enough separation, like if it's only 2 years, you don't get much of an impact. And so in that sense, I think it really was worth our taxpayer money to discover, you know what, if you really want your teenagers to behave prudently, you need to, you know, throw in a chaperone. Don't call them that. That's one way to kill the whole thing. But someone who's, say, about 4 to 5 years older than the rest of them. And they don't even have to say anything. That was the other thing that was in the research study. Just the fact that they're there. They don't have to be telling them, look, you know, this behavior you're suggesting is not very wise. They don't even have to say a thing. Just their very presence causes them to behave more prudently. Yes.
Did they distinguish between, say, an older sibling as opposed to just another person who's 4 years older?
The research didn't include that. From what I can tell, they basically were taking someone who was a total stranger to the group. So they didn't know who he or she was. Total stranger. And basically told them, look, you don't have to say anything, just go with them. So the very fact that there is this older person that's with the group is enough to cause them to make more prudent decisions than they otherwise would. So I guess if it's an older brother, I don't know, it'd be interesting to pursue that as well. Anyway, that was one discovery that I said, well, you know, that's not all that amazing. So, but here's one that is. Let me jump to this character here. And I got a question here for you. What's the difference between, you all know what this is, right? It's a chimpanzee. So in terms of all the non-human animals, it's the chimpanzee that's closest to us in terms of sociability. But here's one chimpanzee and another. Okay, well, what's the difference? No, he wasn't on a cell phone. So, but what's the difference between these chimpanzees and this chimpanzee? Pardon me? They're a different species? No, they're both chimpanzees. Yeah, they're all the same species. That is from the very same region. Well, the point I'm making is this guy is a loner. And just like with humans, there are chimpanzees that are loners. They don't socialize with other chimpanzees. And likewise, they discovered there are some chimpanzees that are very gregarious. In other words, they're always interacting with other chimpanzees, and there are others that are more introverted. So, kind of just like us, some of us are introverts and some of us are extroverts, and a few of us are hermits and loners. But the research study here was really targeting the hermits and the loners. And what they discovered was that their gut microbiome was not as diverse as it was for the socially more interactive ones. Now, in one sense, that seems to be reasonable, because after all, if you throw a bunch of young chimpanzees together, they share pathogens. And we all know that. You know, all you need to do is throw one sick toddler into the preschool group, and they all get sick. But there's a group of scientists that said, I wonder if that's also the case with friendly bacteria, the bacteria that are crucial for maintaining our health. And so they did this experiment on chimpanzees and discovered that indeed is the case. And so sociability is necessary for us to. And so, for example, it's really important for infants is that, if you've got a child that's 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, it's important they spend time with their peers and socialize with their peers, because that will actually give them a healthier micro-gut biome than they otherwise would get. But what the study was pointing out is not just the case for the infant chimpanzees, it's also the case for the adults. So apparently it's important to maintain the health of the bacteria in our gut that we socialize with one another. And maybe it gives you some another rationale to take more seriously that verse in Hebrews 10. Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves with one another. It's good for your spiritual health. Evidently, it's also good for your physical health. And there's been a number of research studies. By the way, if you're looking at my Twitter account, you'll see I've been posting a number of research papers about recent discoveries of how important it is to take care of your gut bacteria. Certain diets will give you a healthier gut bacteria. And by the way, there's two research papers I know of that basically say your brain will function a lot better if you take good care of your gut microbiome.
An amazing discovery this week in the world of astronomy. What's that about?
Well, I actually did a podcast about that 2 days ago, or back on Thursday. And that has to do with an announcement from Caltech, two Caltech astronomers, who claimed that they may have found evidence for a ninth planet. So maybe their children have to memorize the names of 9 planets now instead of 8. Pluto got demoted, but they're trying to promote another one. And it got a lot of play on the Internet. However, having looked at the paper is quite conservative in its claims, unlike what's been spread all over the Internet. What you see in the paper is these two astronomers have found a place in the Kuiper Belt. You say, what's the Kuiper Belt? It's a belt of comets and asteroids that exist beyond the orbit of Neptune and out to about 50% beyond. So about 4 to 6 billion miles out from the sun is a belt of asteroids and comets that's much bigger than the what we call the main belt that exists between Mars and Jupiter. And these two astronomers notice that there's a place within the Kuiper Belt where the orbits of several of the larger Kuiper Belt objects overlap. And they're basically saying one possible explanation for the overlap of these orbits is that there's a planet out there that's altering the orbits of these Kuiper Belt objects. And if it's a planet that's solely responsible for the overlap of these orbits, then the planet would be 10 times the mass of the Earth. So it'd be like a mini Neptune. To give you some idea, Uranus and Neptune come in at 14 and 17 times the mass of the Earth. This would be 10 times the mass of the Earth. So yeah, that's a significant planet hanging out there. Now, most astronomers are very skeptical that this is actually a planet that's been detected. And by the way, read the research paper. They're not claiming that they detected a planet. They're just saying we found this knot where all these planetary orbits overlap. There's several possible explanations. One of the possible explanations is as a result of the gravitational pull of a planet that's 10 times the mass of the Earth. And so the paper was concerned, saying it's possible. They're not saying probable. They're not saying definite. But the reason for the skepticism in the astronomical community, number one, there's been some very deep searches to find large Kuiper Belt objects. And, actually, that's one reason why Pluto got demoted. They were finding some objects that were the size of Pluto, a little bit smaller, and one that was actually larger. So they said, hey, you know, Pluto's actually smaller than our moon. So they said, we got to demote Pluto. It's not a true planet. But there's been papers published where they said, we've done a deep search and we can confidently rule out the existence of anything the mass of Mars or bigger. Not just up to 6 billion light years, but up to 20 billion light years. And so, you know, now you've got to explain why that survey didn't pick up this planet 10 times the mass of the Earth. And then another reason why there's a lot of skepticism is because of the success of what's called the Nice model. I think I spoke about this in class like 4 or 6 months ago. It's a model produced by a team led by Alessandro Morbidelli, and he happens to work at the observatory in Nice, France. So they refer to his model as the Nice model. But it's a model he and his team have been refining for 15 years. And the model basically explains the origin and development and history of the solar system. And this is the only model out there that explains all the properties of all 8 planets of our solar system and also the properties of the 5 asteroid and comet belts. And that model did not predict that there would be a stable planet that would be a mini Neptune out there in the Kuiper Belt. It did predict that there were 5 gas giants in the primordial solar system and how the interaction of Jupiter with one of the mini Neptunes actually kicked that planet out of the solar system. So people have been saying, well, maybe we can fine-tune the Nice model so instead of the planet being strongly ejected out of the solar system, it hangs around in the outer part of the solar system. However, having looked at the model, that would really be a very difficult thing to pull off. And so the fact that the Nice model doesn't predict this planet and the fact that we haven't seen the planet and we should have seen the planet is really out there tells us it's probably one of the other possible explanations for why you get this overlap of orbits. And one of the possible explanations is it's just a coincidence. I mean, planetary orbits, where you've got a whole bunch of randomly orbiting asteroids and comets out there, they're going to overlap. But it is interesting that so many overlap in this one small region. And others have suggested, well, maybe it was a star that passed by the solar system, say, a couple of million years ago, that might explain that. That's a much more likely explanation than the existence of a 9th planet. So, hey, you can tell your children and grandchildren they only have to memorize the name of 8 planets. And, yeah, nobody is suggesting a name for this thing yet. So, yeah, that was a big announcement, but sometimes big announcements don't pan out in the long term, and that's the prediction of most astronomers. But I think what's good is they're basically saying we need to study the Kuiper Belt in much more detail because there's probably a lot of interesting discoveries that are going to come out of that. And let's find out what's really the cause of these orbital overlaps.
What are the names of the 5 asteroid belts?
Let me see if I can pull them off by memory. There is the main belt, which exists between Mars and Jupiter.
That's the Van Allen, isn't it?
No, it's not the Van Allen belt. The Van Allen belt has to do with the magnetic field about the Earth. So you got the main belt of asteroids, and for a long time that was the only belt we knew of. It's the closest one. The Kuiper belt is the one we've been talking about, and it's what's called the scattered belt, which are asteroids and comets that exist between the orbits of Jupiter and Neptune and a little bit beyond. Then there's what's called the centaurs. And the centaurs exist literally from about the orbit of Uranus and Neptune out to about 20 billion light years. And then the biggest belt of asteroids and comets is the Oort cloud. It's the most distant. That actually goes up to 2 trillion miles away from the Earth. So it's an enormous belt. And by the way, when we look at other planetary systems, we frequently see the equivalent of an Oort cloud around them. And so, you know, the nearest star is 4 light years away, and we have a belt of comets that exists halfway out to the nearest star. So, hey, I did pull it off by memory. Yes, go ahead.
I did read the publication, not the scientific publication, but I don't know what came out in the news or something.
Right.
And these guys, they do make some claims of several circumstances that haven't been explained other ways, and I guess I'm left with the impression, a little bit more positive impression than what you've explained. I don't know that much about it, but I'm just saying that was although this planet has never been observed, it's strictly based on calculations. The fact is that these calculations did seem to explain some things that couldn't be explained otherwise.
Yeah. It's difficult to explain the overlap of those orbits without some kind of gravitational disturbance. I mean, it could be just a sheer coincidence. That's a long shot. The skeptics to this discovery are basically saying we think a more likely explanation is a close star passby. And by the way, some biologists like that too, and paleontologists, because if you go back about 2 million years, there was a major extinction event on the Earth. And so if we had a star coming by, our star, say 2 million years ago, that could explain a rush of bodies coming into our planet, which could cause a minor extinction event, and also could explain the knots of these planets. Now, from what I can tell, that seems to be where a lot of astronomers are going with this discovery. But yeah, I mean, these two Caltech astronomers aren't nobodies. They're famous astronomers.
The one fellow is the fellow that made the argument to discredit Pluto as a planet.
That was Brown, right.
Yeah,
and so he rarely lends his name to something that's hyper-speculative. So the fact that his name is on the paper is significant. And, you know, they do make the point in the paper. I mean, this is not a trivial observation we've made. It demands an explanation. However, a lot of astronomers have jumped in and said, it's very difficult for us to believe that there's a stable planet 10 times the mass of Earth sitting out there. For one thing, it would be fairly bright. Because after all, you can see Neptune through a pair of binoculars. And this thing is only another, 50% farther away. So how do you explain the fact no one has seen this for all these decades? So that's one question. And the fact is they've actually searched for planets as tiny as Mars that have not found anything. But again, as you go back at those search papers, you can't claim that they were exhaustive. It is possible that we've misseen this thing. However, a number of astronomers saying that's a real long shot, that we could have missed it all these years. So that's kind of the status of the thing. This is a thing where we'll wait and see. And hey, if it does turn out that there's a planet out there. And by the way, some people have asked me this question. What if there really is a planet 10 times the mass of Earth out there? What would that mean in terms of life here on planet Earth? And the bottom line is it wouldn't mean much at all. It's just so far away. Neptune does play a minor role in protecting us from taking hits from asteroids and comets. It's the most minor of the gas giant planets that are out there, but it does play a significant role. This thing being out 50 astronomical units or more would play a much more minor role than Neptune itself. Neptune is more massive and it's a lot closer. So it's far enough away that it really doesn't factor into anything. However, I think the biggest impact, if it would turn out to be real, is what do you do with the NEAS model? The NEAS model has been so incredibly successful in predicting the origin and history of our solar system, predicting things like the late heavy bombardment, the Grand TAC model. It's just so remarkably successful. And it predicted an ejection rather than us keeping the planet. Now, I do think the model could be tweaked, but you probably would want to put the gas giant planet a little farther away than 50 astronomical units to make that model really work. So, again, it's a wait and see. But I think this thing got way more publicity than what it really deserved. It's something that we astrophysicists should be talking about in the literature and saying, how do we explain the overlap of these planets? But, hey, this is the Internet. And, you know, and by the way, Caltech made a public announcement, so the reporter's there, and it's no wonder it got all over the Internet. Yes?
Yeah, those two Voyager satellites launched in the 70s, did they surpass the Kuiper belt yet? Or?
Yes, one of them's way beyond the Kuiper belt at this point. So.
Into the Oort.
Yeah, it's going out into the Oort cloud. And by the way, I've run into astronomers, young Earth creationists, who deny that these belts exist, that there is no Oort cloud, there is no centaurs, but we've actually seen comets that are part of the Oort cloud. So the Oort cloud is real. And by the way, we see Oort clouds around other stars. So, however, I think I've said this before in the class, we are in a unique planetary system. When you look at other planetary systems, what's typical is that they have no asteroids and comets at all. Nothing. And that would be a problem for advanced life, to have no comets and asteroids. And the other thing we see are planetary systems with asteroid and comet belts 100 to 1,000 times bigger than ours. What's really rare is that we have small asteroid and comet belts, just the right size and just the right distances to sustain advanced life here on planet Earth. We don't see any equivalent to what we see here in our solar system. And it's all because of what they found in the NEAS model, is that what's unique about the gas giants in our solar system is that they didn't just stay where they were formed, and they didn't migrate in towards their star. As we're finding these gas giant planets, and other solar planetary systems, their gas giant planets either don't move from their birth site, in which case the asteroid and comet belts remain intact, and you get these enormous asteroid and comet belts. Or the other situation is they migrate in towards their star, and when that happens, they destroy all the asteroid and comet belts. What's unique about our solar system is that Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune migrated inward from their birth sites, stopped, and went back, and actually went out a little bit further. And the impact of that is it stripped our asteroid and comet belts by a good factor of 100 to 500 times, giving us exactly the right sizes and distances of our asteroid and comet belts. By the way, you all know why we need asteroids and comets? Yeah, we need it for the water. Our planet would be bone dry if it wasn't for the fact that there were asteroids and comets that remained after the moon-forming event. When that planet, Theia, collided with the early Earth, we lost 100% of our water. Our planet was bone dry. No atmosphere, no water. And it was what's called the late veneer, which was a small rain of comets onto the surface of the Earth that gave us the atmosphere and the thin atmosphere and the thin ocean that is necessary for advanced life. So, thanks to our gas giant planets, we have what we need. And by the way, here's another benefit. A lot of the metals that we mine are mined from asteroids that collided with the Earth. So, for example, 50% of the nickel that's been mined and refined here on planet Earth has come from an asteroid collision event in Sudbury, Ontario. And 80% of our gold comes from an asteroid that collided in South Africa. So, hey, next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the fact that we have these five asteroid and comet belts that are just right to sustain advanced life here on planet Earth. One reason why you don't want a whole lot of asteroids and comets is that getting collision events, say, every couple of years that wipes out whole states is not a good idea. So we fortunately have so few collision events that we can sustain advanced civilization, but we have enough to sustain advanced civilization. Yes?
passing star, as you have talked about. Binary systems are not good. Binary stars are not conducive for life. I can't imagine a star passing near our star without wrecking literal hell with it.
Well, it depends how close it comes by.
How small a star and what distance are we talking about?
Well, you're probably talking, like, for example, we do know that our solar system passed fairly close to what's called the Centaurus Star Association about 2 to 3 million years ago. And there's actually evidence that we received a bath of short-lived radionuclides back at that time. And some people have said maybe that's what's responsible for the extinction event we see there. There's a huge extinction of rodents that took place at that time. And so supernova exploding as we went by the Star Association could explain that. But it's also possible that as we passed by the Centaurus Star Association, we actually got fairly close to one of the stars in the association, and there was a gravitational disturbance that caused the asteroid and comet belts to be slightly disturbed. And that could be part of the explanation.
How close would that have been?
Well, it depends on the size of the star, but we're probably talking something that passed within 1 or 2 trillion miles. So, okay, not close enough to wreck our orbit, but close enough to send an extra shower of asteroids and comets towards the Earth. And close enough that, you know, we may have received more radiation exposure. So, and it may have explained this little knot of orbital crossings that we see in the Kuiper Belt. So,
what is that in terms of light years? You said 1 or 2 trillion miles.
Okay, 1 light year is 5.9 trillion miles.
So that's very close then.
Yeah, it's like the closest star is 4.25 trillion miles away.
Today.
Pardon me, 4.25 light years away.
Yes.
So, yeah, we're talking something closer than a light year. So, yeah. And by the way, some models say if it's a big star and it passed within, say, 4 or 5 trillion miles, that would be enough to explain it. Again, it all depends on the mass of the star and how close it would have to be. And that's kind of what this paper is talking about, is we need to do more research on the Kuiper Belt because we might learn things about the past history, relatively recent past history of our solar system. And, you know, I'm kind of excited about it because it could tie into some discoveries that are being made in biology and paleontology. And also gives us some idea what the risk is for the future. Maybe we should be taking on insurance against a star coming by us within a few million years from now.
What extinction event was that? 2 million years ago?
Well, a lot of rodent species went extinct about 2 million years ago. And, it didn't affect too much the insects, but keep in mind that land mammals are probably the easiest creature to wipe out with some kind of radiation event. And so, they'd be sensitive to that.
Not bigger mammals?
Bigger mammals, maybe, but for some reason the rodents got hit. So, and keep in mind, this is the subject of some debate because the error bars on the dating of this are pretty broad. And so, here you got astronomers with big errors. You got paleontologists with big errors trying to figure out what's going on, which I think is the value of this paper out from Caltech, is maybe more research on the Kuiper Belt and other asteroid belts will tell us a lot more about the history of life here on planet Earth.
What's the percentage of error on this past week's announcement, so-called announcement?
Well, where the error bars are small is they show a map showing these orbits, and the orbits are fairly well determined. The paper does call for a better determination of the orbits, so there is an error bar on the orbits and the orbital paths, and that needs further research. So there's significant errors there. However, there is a general consensus that, the overlap of these orbital paths is real. It's not something that's going to go away just because, hey, the error bars are big. But the researchers are saying we'd like to have better determined orbits.
Well,
Yes.
Do you have a topic prepared for today?
I got a topic prepared for today. We're off topic, right?
More discovery.
So, okay. Anyway, back to these chimpanzees. Basically, the paper ends with making the point that maybe we need to do more research on humans. If there's a benefit for the microbiome, the gut microbiome of chimpanzees, chances are there might be for humans as well. And by the way, the reason there's so many papers coming out on this, it's well known that the more technologically advanced nations of the world and people live in them, like us, we tend to have much less healthy gut microbiomes than the rest of the world. And so that's one of the disadvantages of having technology and wealth. You don't get enough contact with other people, and you're not eating the right kind of foods because you got the money to eat whatever you want, and therefore you wind up not having as healthy a gut microbiome. But I think what's really been interesting for me is the degree to which your gut microbiome affects your capacity to think and affects your well-being. And that's one of the things that was a real key part of this research paper, is that the more social chimpanzees felt better about themselves than the loners did. And you probably noticed that with humans as well, right? But their claim is that it has to do with the microbiome. The gut microbiome is actually more responsible for your sense of well-being than otherwise would be the case. But hey, I wanted to alert you to another paper. This was also published in the journal Psychological Science. And the title of the paper is Awe Expands People's Perception of Time, Alters Decision-Making, and Enhances Well-Being. Okay, and what they did is the research, okay, people who regularly expose themselves to awe-inspiring experiences. Think of going to the national parks, okay, or maybe being challenged by a special kind of movie or whatever. But what they said is that people who regularly have awe-inspiring experiences have a number of benefits, and I'll just list them here for you. Number one, they think they got more time. Okay, that's interesting. You're actually taking time off to have an awe-inspiring experience, and one of the benefits is you come back and you think, I got more time to do whatever I want to do. Whereas people who are basically saying, I don't have time to go on a vacation and have an awe-inspiring experience, say at the Grand Canyon, they actually become more tense about the amount of time they got to accomplish what they want to do. Significantly more patient. People actually take time to have awe-inspiring experiences, are more patient with themselves and with other people and about their work assignments. And they're more willing to volunteer their time to help other people. They said that was one of the things that they just were not expecting at all, that people who actually take time to have these experiences actually wind up wanting to, they give more money to charitable causes, and they volunteer their time to help people that are in need. They have greater life satisfaction, and then the bottom line, something else they didn't expect, is that these are people who prefer experiences over to accumulating material possessions. So they're basically saying, we think it's a good idea that corporations would encourage their employees to take vacations and have awe-inspiring experiences. So probably what it means is you need to take the right kind of vacation. And, you know, this really encouraged me because that's kind of what Kathy and I love to do when we go on vacation. We try to find the most awe-inspiring places in the world and go there and just experience it. And as I read the papers, that's exactly the impact we have. I mean, for example, I wasn't here last Sunday. For 4 years, I've been trying to find a 4 or 5 day window in our schedule where I could take Kathy to see the Great Barrier Reef off of Belize. That's something she's always wanted to do, is snorkel on that reef. It's the second biggest barrier reef in the world. And unlike the one in Australia, it's easy to access. I mean, you're talking just a few miles off the coast of Belize. So that's where we went. But I'll tell you, it was an awe-inspiring experience. The biggest coral I've ever seen, coral 15 and 20 feet high. and just the fish you see there. And so Kathy had an awe-inspiring experience there. But if you go to my Facebook account, she also broke her arm in a jungle hike we did. So that was the first day of our, quote, awe-inspiring vacation. But she broke her arm and loved the jungle. It's a jaguar preserve and just an incredible place to hike. And, we were the most fit people in the group, so they let us hike 9 miles instead of the typical 4. But on the last hike, she broke her arm right about at the wrist. However, if you know anything about Kathy, number one, she's a risk taker. I'm not a risk taker. I always like to keep things as safe as possible. But when it happened, she said, I'm not going to let this stop me. They took her to the hospital. She got a temporary little cast on her arm. And then she made me talk to the guides to rig up a waterproof double bag thing for her arm, because the doctor says you can't get this thing wet. And she says, well, he didn't say, said, yeah, I don't want you getting in the water. And he said, well, what I heard is I'm not supposed to let the thing get wet. You know, so we actually rigged her up where she had, we actually took an old wetsuit so to make a firmer on her upper arm here, double bagged her. Anyway, she went snorkeling with a broken arm. They even had to rig up a float because the arm had to stay up. So they rigged up a float for her arm. She swam with the other arm. So.
Do you have any pictures?
Oh, yeah. Go to my Facebook page. I actually show a video clip of Kathy snorkeling through the water with her little rig up there. So. But yeah, if you know Kathy, that's her spirit. She's just not going to say, there's no way I'm not going to have this awe-inspiring experience. But yeah, I showed her this paper. Pardon me?
What's your food like in Belize?
I didn't hear that.
What's your food like?
Oh, food?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of sugar content. So I had a hard time there. But if you manage to get the sugar out of the way, it's really great food. No, we had good food. A lot of fruit. But it's kind of Caribbean where they throw sugar into everything. Yes.
Yeah. I only have to go to Sierra Madre to see you and this class. We have an awe-inspiring.
Well, thank you. And you know, one of the things about living here is that you get to look up and see the mountains. So, I used to get these photos from his sister. I had a sister who lived in Saskatoon for a number of years. And she sent me these photographs that she took outside of her property. And it'd be pure white. I mean, after all, it's flat as flat can be. And it snows for 8 months of the year. And so that's not very awe-inspiring. But we have the privilege of living here in Southern California, where you've got the ocean and the mountains just so close. And so do take advantage of it. I mean, when I drive to church, I always look at the scenery around me and just thank God for the fact that we have that privilege. But the other thing I got from this research paper, and this actually ties in with our text, God has created for us a very awe-inspiring planet. You look at the animals, you look at the plants, you look at the scenery around you, you look at the people he's created around you. I mean, human beings are awe-inspiring. And in that sense, I think that's one thing that comes from this study of these chimpanzees. There's a real benefit to spending time with one another, and the Bible actually encourages to do that. Don't be a loner. And by the way, the study actually talked about the introverts and the extroverts and made the point that introverts are just as sociable as extroverts. They just socialize in a different way. I think that's really true. So if you're an introvert, you can be a social animal. You don't have to be the gregarious type, but you do need to be interacting with your fellow beings. Okay, with that, let's jump into the text. I just had an awe-inspiring experience reading these research papers. Oh, and by the way, my sons were joking with me saying, Dad, all you need for an awe-inspiring experience is to look at an equation. So, and there's some truth about that. I mean, I remember the first lecture I heard at the university in physics, and what the professor said, there is nothing more beautiful and elegant than an equation of physics. So not all of us were quite convinced right away, but after a few problem assignments, I think, yeah, we got there. Okay. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. The theme of Ecclesiastes is the latter part of the chapter. Is talking about judgment and talking about justice. And verse 11, he's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. And when you think about that, an argument for the existence of God. If there was no God, we'd be able to explain everything after having been on this planet for tens of thousands of years. We should be able to explain everything that we see. We don't. I mean, these research papers are talking about the overlap of these planetary orbits. We haven't got it figured out. And no matter how much we continue to do research, we'll never get to the bottom of everything. Isn't that an argument for the existence of God? The fact that no matter how much money we spend on scientific research, there's always more to learn. Matter of fact, you can talk to any preeminent scientist and ask him, how much do you know about your discipline? Well, maybe 0.00001%. I mean, we're all struck with the humility of how little we know about what we can see and measure. Now, if there was no God, that shouldn't be the way it is. We should have exhausted. We should have gotten to the bottom of the barrel by now. The fact is, the deeper we dig, the more we recognize we're just scratching the surface. Okay. What has already been and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. The promise here is judgment is coming. As we mentioned before in the class, in John 16, Jesus makes the comment that we all know that judgment is coming. You know, eternity has been written on our hearts. We all recognize that this life isn't all there is. The reason why we face death differently than the animals, we know this life isn't it. There's more to this life than our few decades here on earth. And this is why we respond to death differently. We all know judgment's coming. We're going to be facing a judge. So when a dog or a cat dies, they're not worried about judgment. And they accept death in a very different way than we human beings do, because we realize, hey, this isn't the end. God will call the past to account. There's a promise there. That will happen. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there'll be a time of everything and a time for every deed. What he's making the point here in verse 16 is that when we look out upon the face of human affairs, we see extreme injustice. I mean, read history books, read the news or watch the evening news. What you see are repeated examples of injustices that don't make any rational sense. People committing crimes that really do not benefit them all. We talk about stupid criminals. But we also have stupid politicians. We also have people making incredibly bad decisions in terms of their own self-interest. And this is what the text here is talking about. We see injustices that don't make sense unless there is a God. The injustices that we see are supernatural. Now, it not only means that there must be a God, it means there must be supernatural forces opposing the work of God to explain the injustice that we see. I mean, it's interesting, you look at the lives of, say, Joe Stalin and Adolf Hitler, how much they were steeped in the occult. And because they were steeped in the occult, they were influenced by these supernatural angelic beings, which caused them to make decisions that were not in their best self-interest. I mean, the idea that you've got Joe Stalin in 1936 and 37 exterminating his best generals, when he knew he was facing the threat of Nazi Germany. It makes no sense. Why would he kill off all of his best military officers? And by the way, it wasn't just the generals. It went all the way down to the lieutenants. And there's one reason why Nazi Germany almost won the war and wiped out Russia, is that they didn't have the military leaders they needed. Stalin killed them all off. He killed 20 million of his own people in the late 1930s, people he desperately needed, to sustain the economy of Russia and to face the threat of the coming world war. Or you've got Adolf Hitler killing off his best leaders in 1943 and 44 and 45. Why would he do that? Makes no sense. The decisions that he made militarily actually caused the war to be shortened by 2 years. So people basically said if it wasn't for Adolf Hitler, the war would have lasted at least 2 more years. And it's because he made these incredibly irrational decisions. But why? If there was no God, that wouldn't have happened. There was no God that wasn't being imposed by supernatural beings that God had created, then this we wouldn't see all these pervasive acts of what we call supernatural injustice. But there's a positive side to that. How often do we see justice taking place that doesn't make sense, where people get their just due in spite of the fact that the justice system is working in their favor? And so you see the flip side. You also see justice that doesn't make sense, unless there's a God working behind the scenes to ensure that the just thing will be done. So both extremes argue that there must be a God. So I think you can see where I'm going with this. Chapter 3 is giving us multiple reasons to believe that there must be a God. A great chapter for the atheist to read. Okay, eternity is written on our heart. Why do we think about eternity? If we weren't going to live forever, why are we so focused on thinking about living forever? I mean, I saw that in attending some atheist conferences, is that they're all focused on whether or not we can persist to exist in this universe for the next trillion years. And they're getting rather depressed by the fact that astrophysics seems to tell us that's not going to be possible. The stars are going to burn out, and we're going to have a hard time finding an energy source to sustain any kind of civilization. So it gets rather depressing when we look at the physics of the universe. But what even motivates us to think about what human life will be like, say, 100 billion years from now? Why are we focused on that? Eternity is written on our hearts, and judgment is written on our hearts. And what has God done from the beginning to the end? We can't fathom everything that God has done. Just the fact that we can't fathom everything and understand everything we even see here on the earth, let alone we see elsewhere in the universe, or at the subatomic level. How close are we to having a complete picture of particle creation? We're not. People have been saying we're going to need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long before we get any understanding. But even if we get that, we still are not going to have a complete model of particle creation. We can't get to the bottom of it all, and that speaks of the existence of God. Likewise, the fact that we see evil, that simply can't be explained. I mean, what I find ironic is that the only positive argument atheists have for the non-existence of God is the problem of evil. I mean, I think you've heard the argument before. If there is a powerful, good God, then he wouldn't make a universe with evil in it. But you can also turn the tables on them. There's too much evil for there not to be a God. So the problem of evil does not support the atheist worldview case. It would if the level of apparent evil could be explained by natural means. But there's evil in the world that defies a natural explanation, especially when you look at human beings' treatment of one another. It's beyond any possible natural explanation. And so the number one and only really positive, by the way, atheists have lots of arguments for the case, but the vast majority of them are negative. Basically, how poorly we Christians argue for God. And so they're basically debunking all of our arguments. But it's not a proof against God. It's just a proof that we humans or we Christians aren't very good at arguing for the existence of God. It's an argument about our talents. It's not an argument against God. The only argument that directly pertains to God, and by the way, they admit this, that the only argument they really have that is positive is the argument from evil. However, there's way too much evil for there not to be a God. Yes?
Rabbi Zacharias gave an interesting argument in that area of when they bring up evil as against God's existence. He says if you bring up the problem of evil, you're automatically assuming the intrinsic value of human beings.
Right.
And therefore, how do human beings get intrinsic value? That can't not come from an atheistic perspective or just a complex set of label blocks. It has to come from a higher level that gave us intrinsic value. And you're back to God.
You're back to God again. Right. Or also what I observed at the atheist conference at Caltech is how all these atheist scientists were all insisting we have purpose, we have value, we have destiny. How can that be if there is no God? If there is no God, we're no better off than a grain of sand. So why are we trying to insist that, hey, there is no God, but we still have ultimate purpose and destiny? How? I mean...
And when you talk about the atheists, not that they don't believe in God, it's that they're angry and they hate God. And when that emotion comes up, I'm always like, oh, if he doesn't exist, why are you getting so emotional about him?
Well, I actually got to say that. By the way, one of the pleasant experiences I had there at that conference of a International Skeptics Society conference at Caltech is how many of the atheists came up afterwards and complimented me and basically told me they had never heard a scientific defense for the Christian faith before. And they actually complimented me, too, just for the fact that I was gracious with the atheists that I was debating and then the Q&A time. But one thing I shared with them was this. I've been here all weekend, and what I notice is all of your messages are targeting the God of the Bible. You seem to give the God of Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam a free pass. It's all targeting the God of the Bible. If you really are committed atheists, why all this focus just on the God of the Bible? And the other thing I said is, if you really are convinced that there is no God, I would expect you to treat the existence of God like you would treat the existence of the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy. But the fact that you show so much passion and you actually have these meetings where you bring people in from all over the world to speak and look at the money you're spending, what that tells me is you really do believe in God, but you don't like him. Now, their reply was very interesting. They said, Dr. Ross, it's not that we hate God, it's that we despise his followers. I said, well, there's something irrational about that. You mean you're letting your relationships with Christians you don't like keep you away from the one that created all of us. Does that really make sense? But it's something you see in the Bible. If you will not forgive others, God will not forgive you. And the rationale behind that, you see that right in Matthew chapter 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount, is Jesus is making the point, no one has been more offended than I have been and I will be. And when you refuse to forgive your fellow human beings, you're basically saying, I have been offended more than the one who came to sacrifice his life for the entire world. And this is why I can't forgive you unless you're willing to forgive others. Now, there's an important caveat to that. Because I actually talked to some of these atheists, and they would bring up cases. I won't mention the names. They mentioned certain Christian leaders that they said they could never forgive. I said, I can understand the offense that you've experienced. But would you be willing to let the creator of the universe help you gain the spirit you need to forgive? I can understand why you're not able to forgive right now, but would you be willing to allow people to talk to you, to God to talk to you, so that you can gain the forgiveness? And some of them said yes. Some of them said never. In other words, they felt that they were so deeply offended, no matter what happens, they couldn't forgive so-and-so. And that is sad, because, hey, we've all been offended, but no one's been offended more than Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe. Yes?
Much of that sounds persuasive, but I would say I would not use the Easter Bunny and Tooth Fairy example, because Easter Bunny and Tooth Fairy makes no claims on anybody's life, on how we should live, and nobody orders their lives according to the precepts of the Easter Bunny and Tooth Fairy. On the other hand, I think the atheists' objections to religion is proportional to the claims those religions make on people. For example, Christianity makes powerful claims on our lives.
Right.
But so does Islam.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find, you know, from a lot of atheists and so on, they will also, you know, condemn Islam for the obvious, you know, the commands to kill and murder and so on. Now, they won't find anything objectionable about, I don't know, Buddhism, for example, because it's nice and fuzzy. It doesn't make any difficult claims on your life, or at least as far as it affects you. So that's the only thing I would say, is that I'm interested in what those atheists, what your experience is. Would they also condemn Islam to the degree that they condemn Christianity?
Well, what you will see then is condemning the monotheistic religions. So Judaism, Islam, and Christianity are often lumped together. And what they talk about is they call it the Bible God. And so when they use the term Bible God, they're typically encompassing not just Christianity, but all those religions, including Mormonism, that would claim to have their faith based on at least parts of what we call the Holy Bible. And so, yeah, they have a beef with the Bible God. And you're making a good point. All those religions are making significant claims on the individual lives of human beings, as opposed to, say, Hinduism and Buddhism, where the claims are, you know, at a much lower level. And so, yeah, I think that partly explains the reaction. It also explains why there's so much targeting, trying to undermine the faithfulness of the Bible. Because if they do that, they knock out all those Bible-based religions. But what I find in my experience with atheists, they have a hard time distinguishing what's so different about Christianity than, say, Judaism. Now, they do realize Islam is quite different, and Mormonism is quite different. They have a harder time distinguishing the difference between Judaism and Christianity. And I think it's an important difference, because a lot of atheists have this idea that Christianity is works-based, just like Judaism is. It's not. Most atheists really do not have a good understanding of the doctrine of grace at all. And so talking to them about the difference between the God of Christianity and the God of Judaism, for example, I think you can get some good headway there. And by the way, I stayed for hours after that debate at Caltech, because the atheists wanted to talk. And when they want to talk, that's a good thing. And so we were able to get through a number of these issues. But I appreciate your point about the tooth fairy. Maybe a better example would be Santa Claus. Because Santa Claus really does make claims on your life, right? You know, naughty or nice. So.
I think you really you would want to make this clarification. The Mormonism is polytheistic. It teaches there are trillions of gods and goddesses in the cosmos. So Mormonism does not teach the God of the Bible.
Yeah, what I meant by the, quote, Bible God is Mormonism, just like Islam, has the Old Testament, the New Testament, and extra books. Judaism has the Old Testament, but not the New Testament. And so that's why atheists kind of lumped them all together, because fundamentally they all at least give a nod to these books. Frankly, I prefer to refer to Mormonism and Islam as Christian cults, because a cult is someone who takes the Bible and adds to it or subtracts to it. So in that sense, I think it's appropriate to refer to both Islam and Mormonism as a cult rather than a different religion, because they both claim that they uphold the Old and New Testament, but they add to it. And by the way, what I find remarkable is how similar the teachings of Islam are to the teachings of Mormonism. Now, you emphasize the difference in the sense that Islam teaches God is one and only one. No Trinity, just one. Whereas what you have in Mormonism is a polytheism, where if you're a good Mormon, you can become a god and rule on a planet. That's where they're different. But look how similar they are. Both have a Latter-day Prophet. In both cases, the Latter-day Prophet was visited by an angel that gave him a message that wound up being an extra book. So you've got a Latter-day book and a Latter-day Prophet, And in both cases, the Latter-day prophet had a visit with an angel that gave him a message. Frankly, I think it was the same angel. Pardon me?
It was supposedly Gabriel in both cases, I believe.
Well, I mean, what do we see in 1 John? Is that Satan will appear as an angel of light to deceive. So, and I don't think they're the only two individuals who've had that experience. But both of them were able to launch major religions. The other thing I find interesting is how similar both faiths are to their doctrine of women. In both cases, women take a lower status. And the women become sex objects in terms of their doctrine of heaven. So their doctrine of heaven is very similar. And in both cases, their doctrine of heaven is something that we humans can visualize. And both deny the Trinity. Now, Mormons will claim that they defend the doctrine of the Trinity, but ask them to define it. What you discover is it's nothing like the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. They are Trinity deniers. And by the way, that's the easiest way to recognize a cult. Every cult denies the doctrine of the Trinity. But watch out for the definitions. Mormons love to use the same terminology, the blood of Christ, the Trinity, Jesus Christ. But what you discover is it's not the same.
Different dictionary.
Different dictionary. Yeah, watch the dictionary.
The exception, of course, is Judaism.
Judaism, yes.
I mean, that's not a cult.
Judaism is not a cult. However, Jews do deny the doctrine of the Trinity.
Of course.
And some people have said on that basis they deserve to be called a cult because they deny the doctrine of the Trinity. However, unlike Mormonism and Islam, they have not altered the Holy Book. And so they basically have a smaller Bible than we have. But after all, they got, you know, 75% of it. And incidentally, it's their books that give the most explicit teaching of the doctrine of the Trinity. I've been able to reach a lot of Jews through that because they say they're taught that we Christians get the doctrine of the Trinity from the New Testament. We don't. We get it from their book, the Tanakh. And the problem is they don't read those passages in the Tanakh that talk about the doctrine of the Trinity, although they do read Genesis 1. And I find that ironic because Genesis 1 explicitly teaches the doctrine of the Trinity. It's right there in the first page of the Bible. But hey, pick up any Jewish Bible, it has a footnote where it uses, say, let us create, you know, Adam and Eve, man and humans, male and female, in our image. The footnote will say, our is the royal we, where God is including the angels. But what does it tell us in Hebrews? Angels cannot create. They can't be part of the royal we. God alone is a creator. And by the way, it's not just the book of Hebrews. In the book of Isaiah, it repeatedly teaches only God creates. No other being can create except God. He alone is the creator. There's only one creator. And I find it interesting how often that's repeated in the book of Isaiah. By the way, we're going to get to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40 through 48 is where you get the most explicit teaching on the doctrine of God and God's role in creation. But those chapters in Isaiah repeatedly tell us that God and God alone can create. Yes?
I don't think that there's any good argument for calling Judaism a cult simply because they were, as everybody agrees, the original chosen people of our God. It's because they chose not to acknowledge the Messiah doesn't automatically turn them on their heads and say they're a cult. We're just following the same rules that were given in the first place.
Hey, yeah, I'm not trying to put that label. I'm just saying it's a debate that's going on in the Christian community. Should we call them a cult and should we not call them a cult? Those who think that they really do deserve the title of a cult are saying they deny the Trinity and they deny the doctrine of grace. The fact that they deny those two points alone is sufficient to put them in that category. But others are saying, well, wait a minute, they're not adding to the Bible, and since they're not, and they haven't just changed the Bible, Jehovah's Witnesses have actually altered various sentences and words in the Old Testament. The Jews, to their credit, have not done that. On the other hand, they've added numerous footnotes in the Tanakh that tell people it doesn't mean what you think it means. It means this instead. And, you know, that too would be the mark of a cult. But it is a debate. And frankly, I'm trying to stay out of that debate. Because, it's amazing to me how many not yet converted Jews support Reasons to Believe. They support us because they like the fact that we are engaged in providing scientific evidence for the existence of the God of the Tanakh. And by the way, I'm finding that Jews are really attracted to this doctrine of grace. It's like, I wish it were true. Well, guess what? It is true. But they have a hard time believing that it's true. But I think that's true of every human being, is that, when we start investigating the Bible and the Christian faith, is it really by God's act alone, and there's nothing I can do to deserve salvation? It's like we're all motivated to think we have to earn what we're taught that. Hey, you want to become an astrophysicist, you've got to go to graduate school. You've got to do something. And so it's ingrained in our culture. And I see that with a number of Jewish leaders I know, is that surely my works are going to count. And the idea they don't count at all is a really hard pill to swallow. But I try to emphasize with them and say, hey, it was hard for me to swallow that too. It took me 2 years before I gave my life to Christ after being persuaded that the God of the Bible exists. And yeah, that was one of the problems. Is this doctrine of grace really, really true? So I think we can get somewhere just by simply emphasizing this. This is a struggle for every human being. But hey, if it is by our good works, none of us are going to make it. And that, by the way, is another thing you see in every cult. Every cult, there is no assurance of salvation. That's the mark of every cult. So no Mormon has assurance of salvation. No Islam has assurance of salvation. Jehovah's Witnesses, no assurance of salvation. It only exists in the Christian faith. And likewise in Judaism, you don't see an assurance of salvation. Let me qualify this. My problem with Judaism is the ism, not their book. I have no problem with their book, and I have no problem with the people, but I have the problem with what people have done with the Tanakh. It's their interpretation of the Tanakh that's my issue. And by the way, you really can make some headway with Jews once they understand that you know their book better than they do. And so that's why I encourage Christians, don't just read the New Testament. Be a student of the Old Testament. And if you're a good student of the Old Testament, you're going to impress a lot of Jews. It really throws them when they meet a Christian that knows the Torah better than they do. They pride themselves that they know the Torah better than anybody else on the planet. And they meet someone that knows the Torah better than they do, it kind of rocks their security. So, hey, those five books that Moses wrote, they're great books. So, and by the way, I love the way the Torah ends. The Torah ends with the gospel. Read those last four chapters of Deuteronomy. It's a powerful presentation of the gospel, where you've got Moses saying, you think that the law is your salvation. It's not. You need to put your faith in the one that God will send. That's how the Torah ends. So I love to point Jews to that. Probably I wanted to read the last five chapters of Deuteronomy. In fact, I remember I was talking to a famous Jewish leader, and I said, don't you think that Moses' last written words are the most important words of Moses to read? He said, well, of course. I said, well, let's look at those last five chapters of Deuteronomy. And I mean, here's Moses, knowing he's going to die, and he's got one last sermon to preach to the Jews. Don't you think he's going to put us all into that final sermon? And yeah, most Jews realize that's the longest message or sermon that Moses gave to the Jewish people. It's the longest sermon he gave, and in my opinion, the most powerful, the most important. And if you can just get Jews to read that, then you can make a lot of headway. Okay, I got 1 minute left. I had a lot I was going to do, I'm not going to make it. So, the whole point here is that in Ecclesiastes 3, you've got five separate arguments proving the existence of God. Arguments that people typically never think about, but is there in Ecclesiastes. And by the way, that's a good way to summarize the book of Ecclesiastes. You got King Solomon here saying, these are all the wrong spiritual paths that I have taken. Learn from my mistakes. But he also interjects all the way through. This is where I made a mistake. Don't you make the mistake. But here is evidence that God was at work. And so it ends with a powerful presentation in the last few sentences of chapter 12 about what really counts in human life. So it's the eternity. By the way, I love what Gavin said in the sermon this past hour, is we can live for these few decades here on earth, and we can structure Christianity around these decades, but we really need to structure it around eternity. And that's exactly where King Solomon ends in the last two sentences of chapter 12. Take a look at that. With that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this amazing book of Ecclesiastes. We want to thank you for this man that you raised up, Solomon, and the way you blessed him beyond any man that's been blessed physically. And Father, help us to learn from his life the paths that we should not pursue, and how we need to eschew material things and focus on relationships, and especially our relationship with you. This is what's going to count for all eternity. Thank you for writing eternity on our hearts, and in many multiple ways, you put a message on our hearts. May we not ignore that. May we realize, Lord, that you're a God that demands a perfect moral performance, and none of us is capable of living up to the moral standards that you've written upon our heart. But you're the one that has paid the price, has made the redemptive price, so we can be delivered from our shortfalls, and we can trade our moral imperfection for your moral perfection. Thank you for your Holy Spirit, who has come into the lives of us who are followers of Jesus Christ and is at work transforming us, where we will eventually gain that moral perfection. In Jesus' name, amen.